The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
But I'll leave them aside. Okay, thank you for that introduction, and thanks for the invitation from Career Services and your IP group. This talk is all about the exam, what it takes to sign up for it, what it takes to qualify to sit for it, and so forth, what it takes to prepare, the time you might set aside, when to take it in your law school career, and then passing it, what happens to you, what the potential is being a patent attorney, what types of things you do as a patent attorney, where you can do them, and finally, because you know it's the cliffhanger quality of information that keeps you coming back, what you get paid, okay, as a patent attorney. Now, I'll tell you up front, you don't get paid like a superstar Japanese pitcher who somebody separated with $51 million just to negotiate with this guy to come pitch in Boston. Don't you think that seems excessive just for the rights to negotiate? Patent attorneys don't get paid that well. Close, okay, but not quite that well. That's before he even throws a pitch, $51 million. Well, in any case, before you all leave law school and head for the pitching machine, let me tell you what it is that you're here to hear about, the patent bar exam. This exam has been around a while. The patent office is unique in that it's the only government entity that sees fit to give you an exam before that you have to pass before they see fit that you can practice before them. Every other government entity, if you're merely an attorney, that is sufficient, you know, having taken and passed some state bar somewhere. But the patent office doesn't even care if you're an attorney. They want you to pass their exam. They're looking to determine if you have a technical background, specifically any engineering or hard science background. So we'll talk about those degrees particularly, but basically any engineering will work, as well as biology, physics, chemistry, microbiology, and all that sort of thing. Any of these things will qualify for you to take the exam. Now, the exam has changed over the years, but it's been around a while, you know, 50 or so years. So by the time you get ready to enter the field, it will still be there. Don't think you can wait this one out until they give up. They're going to continue giving this thing. The current format, however, is, liked by some, not by others. It is multiple choice. There's five possible answers. There's only 100 questions. And all you have to do is get a 70. Even better, it's open book. That's right. They give you the book from which all the questions come from. This book is a fun little pamphlet about 3,000 pages long. It's a book called the MPEP, Manual of Patent Examining Procedure, MPEP. But it's really well written, got interesting plots and characters. No, it has none of that. It's about like a phone book. No, not even that interesting. Phone books have stadium plans and other things that are useful. The MPEP just is. Now, here's a test. They give you the answers. You merely have to pick the right one. They give you the source of all the questions, and yet the pass rate is 50%. It's lower than any state bar with the exception of California in February. So, what's the deal? You know, I mean, how hard can it be? All you have to do is get a 70, they give you the answers, they give you the book. Well, the problem is this. Most people go in thinking it's a test of patent law. And it is, but only to a very slight extent. All the law you need to know can literally be put on a single sheet of paper, double-sided. And that's Title 35 United States Code, barely four sections of the law. What's more tested are the rules, and that's 37 Code of Federal Regulations. You need to know about 20 or 25 rules, and you need to be familiar with maybe another 20 beyond that, for under 50 anyway. But what it's mostly a test of is this book called the MPEP, the Manual of Patent Examining Procedure. And the only people who are familiar with this are patent examiners. And even patent examiners aren't that familiar with it. I mean, they look at it from time to time as a resource, but it's not like they read it every day. It sort of supports their elbow or something. You know, it's a big, thick thing. And so people show up at the exam thinking, I'm smart. I've taken and passed tests. Indeed, here's the morale-breaking part. Everybody who shows up for this test is a really talented individual, right? They have a background in engineering or hard science. half have taken and passed state bar exams. They're attorneys already. So this group of people has succeeded at almost everything they've ever attempted. And here they show up and fail in droves, like wheat into a threshing machine, okay? So let's not make it that way for you. Let's make this a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So now you know what the exam is like. It's a test of this book called the MPEP. How do you sign up for it? Because I know now you're anxious to get going. Well, you have to get a hold of a thing called the General Requirements Bulletin. General Requirements Bulletin. This thing is available at the USPTO website, which I've put up here. It's www.uspto.gov. You go there, you go to the Office of Enrollment and Discipline, Office of Enrollment and Discipline, and you download the current version of this thing, the General Requirements Bulletin. Now, in here, up front, they'll tell you all of the degree requirements in order to sit for this thing, and I'll just go over a few of them here. Any hard science, beginning with biology, biochemistry, botany, some computer science programs, and these would be those accredited by certain accrediting committees, and you can check in the requirements bulletin to see if yours qualifies. Electronics technology, food technology, general chemistry, marine technology, microbiology, molecular biology, organic chemistry, and so forth, on down to physics and textile technology. Any hard science, and then any engineering from aeronautical through petroleum. Basically, fill in the blank. If engineering follows it, you're probably in. Now, this would make you category A. Keep that in mind as I go along. If you don't have a degree in one of those subjects, but rather you have a degree in another subject, but you have a certain accumulation of science courses like physics, physics and chemistry, biology, botany, microbiology, you know, you're probably the unusual person with a degree in history or French horn and then 24 hours in semester and semester hours in physics, but hey, it might be you. Okay, you might have started in physics or chemistry or engineering and then found your way into a math degree or something like that, or computer science, something. You may have accumulated enough science courses on the way through your undergraduate experience to qualify, and this would make you category B. You have a degree in something else, but you have the approximate course equivalent of a hard science degree. They are happy to have you. So check out if you are a category B candidate. And naturally, there's always category C, which is other. And what other is in this case is they're looking for a sufficient scientific or technical background, and proof of that would be having taken and passed an engineering training test or a fundamentals of engineering test given by a state, something like that. And so if you fall out under any one of these categories, you can sit for this exam. Now, in terms of which category you are, this will determine how quickly the patent office turns around your admission ticket. And so if you're category A, you submit everything to the patent office with a check for $390, 390, and they will send back to you an admission ticket within about 2 to 3 weeks. 2 to 3 weeks, okay? Now, what this does is it gives you a 90-day window within which you go ahead and take this exam. You schedule it and take it. You contact a local Prometrics facility. You don't take it at the patent office. You take it at your convenience at one of these facilities. If you're category B, your admission ticket is turned around in about 4 to 6 weeks as opposed to 2 to 3. And if you're category C, well, it takes them as long as it takes them. But regardless, the outcome is the same. When you hear from them, a 90-day window begins. And it's at your convenience you contact these people, so you don't have to wait for a twice-a-year event like a regular bar exam. This is any time of the year that suits yourself. So, can any one of you find a day in 90 to go take a one-day exam? And the exam is 3 hours and 3 hours, 50 questions and 50 questions. Can you find the day? Sure you can find that day. The more difficult thing is finding the time to prepare for this exam, and that's what you need to focus on. This exam, if you don't take a course like the one I teach, is going to take about 300 hours to get ready for. You need a copy of the MPEP, make sure it's the one that's tested at the moment. That's 8th edition, revision 4. 8th edition, revision 4. The one that's on the Patent Office website is 8th edition, revision 5. So make sure you're preparing off the one that's going to be tested as opposed to the one they use in practice. They're usually slightly out of sync, okay? And that's because they introduce the MPEP and then they start writing questions to accommodate what changed, and then by the time they do, they come out with the next edition. So be certain you're studying the right one. Get some old exams. You can get them off the PTO website or you can get them at pli.edu. We have a more complete collection at pli.edu. But either place, you get the MPEP, old exams, 300 hours. If you take a course or any course, not just the one we give, but any of them, you will make your preparation time more efficient and focused. You'll roughly cut it in half. So it's still 150 hours. This is not an inconsiderable undertaking for you to be able to take this exam. It's going to take some time for you to pull this off. And so the question is, when do you have that time? It's not, when can I take the exam? That's just a day. The critical thing is, when do I have time to prepare? Is it during winter break? Is it during spring break? Is it during summer break? Or if I get a home study version of whatever course I'm taking, can I work it into my law school experience? You know, when can I make this happen? When can I find this 150 hours? Now, the difference between a live and a home study course is not what's covered in the course. Just bear this in mind. It's what works for you. For a lot of people, they need somebody at the front of the room saying, do this next, all right, now let's go over it, now do this. They need that to get them organized and get them focused. For others, a home study course can work, okay? You can go ahead and do this on your own. You can have it delivered to your house. You can go through it on your computer or whatever works for you, your DVD player and so forth, and you can kind of work it into your existence. But I know for a lot of people, without a date certain approaching associated with a live course, they have trouble getting organized. You know, they get that home study box and they're just full of good intentions, and 6 months later, they're still full of good intentions and so is the box, okay? It's untouched, it's gaining dust. So think about which format works for you. The cost is probably the same. The other thing to factor in is if you do a live course, if it's not here in Washington, bear in mind you got to go somewhere to do it, so that's going to add to your cost. It's not just the cost of the course, but you're going to have transportation, lodging, and all that sort of thing. But in any circumstance, a course will help you focus. Think about that in terms of buying back your own time. You're roughly going to cut your preparation time in half. Now, when during your law school experience should you go ahead and take this exam? Well, whenever you're ready to. There's nothing to wait for because nothing in law school further qualifies you. What qualifies you is your technical background, okay? Either you have a scientific or engineering degree or you don't, and law school isn't going to make up the difference, okay? No physics courses here. Next, nothing in law school further prepares you for this exam. Unless a course uses the MPEP as a text, it's not going to be helpful. Most law school courses teach from law school type text. They talk about cases and stuff that relates to what a patent is good for, how it might be enforced, ramifications of losing one, and that sort of thing. They don't focus on this narrow slice of life at the patent office, which is all about writing and filing and prosecuting applications through the patent office. So while a course in law school may make you more motivated, you know, to take this exam, it's not necessarily going to prepare you to take the exam. It'll just make you more interested. So, what are you waiting for? You're waiting for yourself to make a decision. So let's talk about doing it early. If you're a 1L or a 2L, well, if you get it on your resume, it's a credential that never goes away. That is, once you're an agent, you're always an agent. What changes once you finish law school and taken past the bar is your label on your registration changes from agent to attorney. Your status changes, but you don't have to take the exam again, nothing like that. And you can do the same work as an agent as a registered attorney. At the patent office, there's no difference at all. What's different between an attorney and an agent is outside the patent office. Attorneys can litigate, license, give opinions, and all that. Agents do none of that. But at the patent office, they're the same. So, if you get this credential, what can you do, you know, during your summer clerkships or part-time during law school? You can do real work and get paid real money. Hey, that sounds like a nice thing to do, right? So get this thing on your resume early. If you leave it out there, well, you've left a real hurdle for yourself after law school. You've left something that's going to require considerable time, 150 to 300 hours. It has a low pass rate. And, you know, you're already going to be working. And you're already going to have no flexibility in your schedule. All the fun you had in law school and the flexibility, you know, and the all-night drinking. No, you guys don't do that. It's rumor. It's all in Hollywood. In any case, all the fun you had and the flexibility will be gone because now you'll be in the, quote, real world. And it's going to be even harder to come by the time you need to get ready for this thing. And besides, you've got the regular bar exam, too. So why leave two things out there, especially one with a pass rate lower than anything else across the country? So go ahead, get it on your resume. It's a great credential. You can do real work, and it distinguishes you from among those who don't have that credential because it's a real indication of your commitment to the field. You've taken and passed a real hurdle to get into it. So think about when you want to take it. My advice is, as soon as you know this is something you want to do, don't take it lightly. I mean, don't just say, yeah, I guess I'll do it. It's going to take real time. It's going to take some money. It's going to take some real commitment. So don't take it lightly, but do it as early as you think it is something you're really interested in doing. All right, any questions about signing up for the exam or the exam experience or anything like that?
What do you think about the option of working as an examiner?
You can work as an examiner, and since you're proximate the patent office, that's a feasible thing. If you work 4 or more years as an examiner, you waive having to take this exam. You just sign right up. And for many an examiner, that's reason enough to stick around 4 years at the patent office. I was only there 2, okay? Sadly, I didn't get that memo. No, I started working as an examiner after 2 years of night school had already gone by, so you know I only had 2 to go. But yeah, you can do that. And working at the patent office is not as bad as it seems in that if you work there, it's a real credential. And what I mean not as bad as it seems, you don't get paid a lot working as an examiner. You start as a 7, become a 9, you know, 11, 12, and so forth. But it's another good thing to have on your resume because it demystifies patent prosecution, and it gives you real credibility when you go out there to find a job because you're going to be sitting on the other side of the desk in terms of what you were just doing at the patent office. So it is a useful thing to do, and if you can do it, you know, it's not a bad alternative. If you don't want to do it, you know, there are other ways to get into the field. Take this exam and head out. Yes?
Some of the other patent bars. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting because I used to write questions for the exam in a former life, and so I know very well what questions are asking and why. And I've done a statistical breakdown of the last 20 years of exams. And so I can tell you without equivocating that 80% of the exam comes from 4 chapters. Do you want to make a note about it? Suddenly the pens are out. Okay. 2/3 of the exam comes from 2 chapters, 700 and 2100. 2/3, okay, 2 chapters. Another 15% or so comes from chapters 600 and 1800. If you get those 4 chapters and you know them cold, you can pass the exam. Sadly, they're the thickest chapters in the MPEP. Darn. 600, 700, 1800, 2100. 600, 700, 1800, and 2100. And if you read and memorize those, you got a shot at this thing. But bear in mind, most people that fail, fail with a 69. They get a point or two short. People that pass, pass with a 71. Okay? There's a huge bump right at 70. It's the magic of this exam, right? If you fail, you claw your way to the, within sight of the finish line and just get to look at it. So, oh well. All right. So, yeah, those are the parts that are tested because I know. I've taught for this course and its major competitor for, about 20 years now. I've looked at this thing probably more than people that write it now. Any other questions about the exam or signing up for it? Okay, how about careers in patent law? You want to hear about those? Huh? Big money. No. You want to help the public. I understand. It's all public interest. Okay. Well, let's talk about the public's interest in your being paid well. Okay, what do patent attorneys do? Patent attorneys. First of all, how do you succeed as a patent attorney? Be one. Okay. And where do you have to finish in your class in order to be a patent attorney? Top 100%. Can you do that? Okay, on the day they're handing out the diplomas, show up. Okay, it's a two-step process. Show up. When they call your name, thank them, walk away. You'll have a job. And the reason is patent attorneys are rare. Now, here's the problem with patent attorneys. What's the definition? Well, they lack sufficient personality to do tax work. Okay. That means, that's right, it'll sink in slowly. You're not going to be the life of the party. Okay. Charisma will not drip from you. So what do you do with this? Well, you have fun, okay, within certain limitations, I suppose. But patent attorneys break into two groups. Those that do prosecution, that's writing and filing of applications at the patent office. You talk to inventors, you write up what they tell you about, and you put it in a form acceptable to the patent office. You follow it through. That's called patent prosecution. At the end of the day, you get them a patent. This is very regular work. An active docket, you might have 300 to 400 cases, depending on how complex they are. And that's a rolling docket. As cases are allowed, you file a few more and so forth. But this is regular work. You go to the same office every day, you work predictable hours, and you have a routine schedule depending on how quickly things are moving at the patent office. Very predictable, and it's plentiful in terms of those jobs here in the Washington area. We'll talk about the geography in a moment. The other thing you can do is litigate. And litigating a patent is like litigating anything else in federal district court. It's exclusively in the federal district court system. There's no spillover into state and municipal courts like there are with trademarks, trade dress, and some copyright stuff. This is only about federal court. And so what's it like litigating? Well, you wake up mad and you stay that way, okay, probably for 6 or 8 months. And that's litigating, isn't it? You're in a hurry. You've got a lot on your plate. You want to do some damage. No, I mean, that's litigating. You're defending a position or pursuing a position. It can be very exciting. You're operating under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I did 10 patent cases, took them through trial and so forth, and then I decided I just wasn't that angry, okay? Now, and you're in a hurry. And the reason you're in a hurry, you're operating under a schedule that's not your own. It's the court's schedule. And they take into account what their parameters are and the fact that you and your witnesses and your documents are on the other side of the international dateline just doesn't care to them, okay? Doesn't matter, rather. And so you find yourself, back and forth across the world with interpreters, et cetera, paralegals, and et cetera, in tow, an entourage this way and that way, into an embassy, out of an embassy, and so forth, all under a time frame that just, the mind boggles. But if that's exciting to you, and it is to some people, there's lots of people that litigate and love it, okay? Good for them. Now, in between litigating and prosecuting, you have licensing, you have opinion work, and you have transactional stuff, due diligence, who really owns the patent, Are there any liens outstanding? You know, all the usual sort of transactional due diligence stuff. And that can be done by a litigating attorney or a prosecuting attorney, the stuff in between. But what's difficult is to combine the respective pursuits. You really can't prosecute and litigate at the same time because they just don't mesh. Prosecution is regular, predictable, and you got to be there. Litigating, well, you're just torn away and off you go. You know, you're pursuing it until it's over, and you can't keep up with a prosecution docket. But this is the thing. You can't litigate without knowing how to prosecute, because prosecution is what introduces all the weakness, to the extent there are, into the patent. Likewise, you can't prosecute without knowing very well how to litigate, because you don't want to introduce problems into the patent that may be exposed later during litigation. So you have to know very well how to do both, but you can't do both at the same time. So where does this work get done? What kind of enterprise will you get a job in? Well, increasingly, a job for you is going to be available in a general practice firm that has a patent group in it. Now, a patent group being in a general practice firm is something that didn't exist when I came out 20, 25 years ago. Gosh, that's a long time. In any case, back then, patent attorneys came out and kind of went off and flocked together, you know, wearing pocket protectors and short pants. And they didn't really mix with regular attorneys for whatever reason, okay? And it's because they considered themselves different and regular attorneys considered them different. But then the big general practice firms recognized, hey, money is at stake here, and we want some of that. And so, most recently, the popular example is BlackBerry. They had to write, what, $642 million check to this firm in Alexandria? Well, 20 years ago, Kodak wrote a $10 billion check to Polaroid. $10 billion. That's right, back in the days when a billion was a billion, okay? And Kodak used to be in the instant photography business. They had a product called the SK70. Maybe you remember, maybe you don't. Well, maybe it was a little bit too much like the Polaroid thing, you know, maybe like a complete copy. So anyway, just a little close. And so, general practice firms said, you know, this is too important to be left to patent attorneys. You know, those pocket protector wearing short pants folks. Let's go over there and get some of this ourselves. And so they started acquiring boutiques, patent boutiques. And so now you'll find a general practice firm with a patent group or something, and that used to be a law firm itself, but separate. Now they get taken up. When I went to work, leaving the patent office, I went to work for what was then the oldest, largest, most prestigious patent firm in the country, an outfit called Cushman Darby Cushman. Gone, sucked up about 15 years ago by Pillsbury, fill in the blank. Okay, you know, whoever their last victim, that's the second name. In any case, these firms have just disappeared into these general practice firms increasingly. And so that opportunity is by now the more pervasive opportunity that you have. Now, in these firms, what do you do? Well, you do anything, prosecution, litigation, the full gamut, transactional stuff, etc. Then there are boutiques. Some are still out there, and some are quite large. The label boutique can be a bit of a misnomer. A big one here in town is Finnegan. Another big one is Shugru. You know, Finnegan has over 200 lawyers by now, and Shugru probably has 150 or approaching 200. You know, it's kind of a misnomer to call them a boutique. What characterizes that, though, is the nature of their practice. It's more or less patents. That's what they do. Sure, they do trademarks and copyrights. You know, they do intellectual property. But by and large, what they do is patents. The trademarks and copyrights are kind of throw-ins. You know, as a consequence of a litigation, there's some counterfeiting, which might bring up trademark issues. And what do you know, they ripped off the instructions to, hey, that's a copyright issue. But the fact that any attorney can do trademark and copyright means any attorney does. But these patent boutiques, they do pretty much patent work. Some of the big ones, you can do anything you want, prosecution, litigation, etc., anything in between. The smaller ones, maybe you'll do more prosecution than you would litigation. You get the occasional case as opposed to the regular sourcing of cases in the larger boutiques. The next place you might work is for a company. You'll be in-house. It's something like a pharmaceutical, you know, Pfizer, Motorola, Microsoft, something like that. Now, these jobs pay perhaps not as well as you would being an attorney on the outside, but you're not doing as much. It's a bit of a lifestyle decision. Whereas at a firm, you kind of work from before dawn to after dusk, even during daylight savings time. At an in-house at a firm, you know, you might arrive at work after the sun has gone up and go home before it goes down, okay? That's nice. You don't get that indoor complexion, you know. So you might actually see the sun in its natural environment. Okay, that's nice, being at a company. You probably won't do litigation. You'll do prosecution. You might do some licensing work. Maybe you'll write a threatening letter. But you won't be standing at a lectern in front of a judge, you know, having at it. You would direct those people who are having at it. You'd pay their bills and that sort of thing. You might also work at a university. Universities increasingly have patent attorneys on staff because universities do a lot of research and they want to try to do some tech transfer, you know, convert some of that research into money coming in. And then there's the government. Now, here in Washington, you know, big government town, you have a lot of patent jobs here, and not just at the patent office. The government spends a heap of money every year on basic research. And this is Department of Energy, Department of Defense, you know, and all the branches, Army, Navy, etc., Department of Agriculture, you know, just heaps of money are spent. Now, you may spend your time where that government laboratory is, like Los Alamos. Okay, you can also sell laptops and meth out there. Do you guys read the news? Okay, that's right. And imagine how sophisticated the meth lab was, right? Well, this was a particle accelerator, but not now. Look, in any case, yeah, or you'd be at Sandia Lab. Okay, that's in Albuquerque. Or you might be at Jet Propulsion in Pasadena, Lawrence Livermore. You know, wherever the government is writing the checks, that's where the research is being done. It could be here in Washington. Naval Research has places around here, lots of government work. So lots of government patent attorneys are out there. Now, where are these patent attorneys? Well, you are in the midst of the largest national concentration of them, Washington, D.C., and Northern Virginia. And the reason, of course, is the patent office is here. But it's more than that. And the reason is half of all applications filed in the United States start outside the United States. So the U.S. Patent Office gets about 500,000 applications every year coming in. 250,000 come from Japan, Germany, Russia, South Africa, and so forth, and they show up here. So where's the work going to go? Well, somewhere near the Patent Office. You know, so it's the Patent Office is here, but it's the nature of the United States being the crossroads of all technology. Anything is patentable here, just about. I mean, there are some restrictions, but just about anything is patentable. And so, what kind of jobs are available here? Well, everything. Government, private industry, boutiques, large law firms, etc., as well as any technology. Whatever your technical background is, there's a job here for you in the Washington area. Next, in New York, you have the next largest concentration, about the same number as Washington and Northern Virginia. But this would include New York City proper, Connecticut, northern New Jersey. What you'll have there are more company jobs. Whereas Washington doesn't have so many company jobs, they have a lot of government jobs as well as the law firms, boutiques, and so forth. New York would have less government but many more company jobs, in-house with pharmaceuticals, electronics companies, and all that sort of thing. After that, the largest concentration is the state of California. They have about the same number as we do here in the city and in Northern Virginia. The difference is they're spread around, and now technology matters. In Northern California, you're going to have semiconductors and software. In the middle and in San Diego, you're going to have some biotech. And in Los Angeles, you're going to have a little bit of everything from the old Defense Department stuff that used to go on. It's going to be in Long Beach, Santa Monica, Pasadena, down in Orange County, and then Newport. Newport has a lot of medical stuff going on down there, and Newport's a nice place, you know. You see it on the OC, okay? Ferrari and a Bentley, and they're delivering pizza, right? You know, it's not so bad out there if you like sun and surf wife and nice cars. In any case, then you can go to Texas. Texas has patent attorneys. They're another fairly large concentration, about half of what you have here in Washington, Northern Virginia, but they're spread around. In Austin, you're going to have semiconductors and software. Dallas, you're going to have that, plus oil and gas. In Houston, it's all oil and gas. Don't even go to Houston unless you're prepared to do something with oil and gas. It just doesn't happen other than that. Now, through the South, there are no patent attorneys. Now, what do I mean by no patent attorneys? Okay, Arkansas has six. Six. Mississippi has 10. Okay, they just don't exist in the South until you get to Atlanta, whereupon there's 300 of them. Okay, and I'm sure the ones in Arkansas are hunting. So, you know, there's just nothing happening across the South. Then you get to North Carolina, there's about 300 of them. That's Research Triangle and that area around that sort of northern North Carolina. And then you get back to Washington. Now, there's also some out in Illinois at Chicago. And again, you're going to have all disciplines. You're going to have law firms, big ones, small ones, boutiques, and so forth, just not the number that you have here. You're going to have little boutiques through the Rust Belt, and these will reflect the industries that used to be there, like Akron, the rubber center of the universe until about 20 years ago. Now, you know, there's not so much left, but that is what's left. It also used to be the center of the oats cutting universe. That was Quaker Oats out there. Hoover Vacuums, yeah, all these people, that's what these places are characterized by, the industries that used to be there. Detroit still has a lot of mechanical and that sort of thing. So, you know, keep that in mind. Pittsburgh, steelmaking and manufacturing, etc. Now, what do you get paid to be a patent attorney? Well, starting patent attorneys in Washington for a big general practice firm started about $135,000 to $145,000 a year. And then, after your fifth year associate, you're making maybe $200,000. And as a partner, junior partner, you know, $250,000, and then you go on up from there. You make somewhat less at smaller boutique firms, less in-house at a company and at a university. And then the government, bear in mind, their working grade for a patent attorney is GS-15, which is not bad in that after 10 years in the government, you've topped out. You can't get paid any more than a congressman or senator, and that's where you end up. There's a certain amount of justice. So there you go. That is what it is to be a patent attorney. It's safe indoor work, and you've got, you know, a 30-year career. What could be wrong with that? You don't even have to kick field goals. That's safe indoor work for the most part. Okay, I'm out of time, and I know you guys are too because you have commitments at 6 o'clock. But if you have questions that you don't get answered while I'm still standing around, just hang on to jwpatent@aol.com. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. But any questions about careers, opportunities, the life you want to live? Okay.